The philosophical and theological roots of not living alone are deeply ingrained in many of our DNA. The book of Genesis tells the story. In the beginning, the Spirit hovers over the face of the waters. God creates the light and the heaven. He puts forth grass and seeds for fruit-bearing trees. And he goes on and on, making the stars. He makes animals that swim, creep, fly, and swarm. He tells them to go forth and multiply. He sends a river out of Eden to water the garden and parts it into four riverheads. After each of those creations, God says, "This is good." And then God makes man. And a short time later says, "It is not good that man should be alone." That's the first time in Genesis that God says, "It is not good." Then God makes Eve, and Adam is no longer alone. In the article Politics, Aristotle wrote, "The man who is isolated, who is unable to share in the benefits of political association, or has no need to share because he is already self-sufficient, is no part of the polis at all, and must therefore either be a beast or a god." I know that I am not alone, in that I was raised in a family where, with the best of intentions, my parents articulated their belief that odds would be much better for happiness for my sister and myself if we found spouses and settled down. It wasn't the only formula for happiness, but it certainly was the primary. Eric Kleinenberg states that human societies at all times and places have organized themselves around the will to live with others, not alone. But not anymore. This is all changing, especially since World War II. In the United States and many countries that have affluence around the world, increasing numbers of people are living alone. In the United States, in 1950, 22% of American adults were single. 4 million lived alone, and they accounted for 9% of all households. Today, more than 50% of American adults are single. They are the majority. And 31 million people live alone. That's compared to 4 million in 1950. And they make up 28% of all U.S. households. In Manhattan, over 50% of the households are folks living alone. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Denmark have the highest percentages of people living alone. Stockholm is the city in the world with the highest percentage of solo dwellers, over 60% of the households. Listen to this. China, India, and Brazil have the fastest growth rates of one-person households. It's a lot of folks. 3 weeks ago, Kristen gave birth to our second son, Ellis. And we're so blessed everybody is healthy. And we have been highly grateful for, I cannot tell you, I'm probably not going to make it through this sentence, how grateful we are for the support and love we have received from this congregation. This is a great place to raise a family and have support, love and ethics support in doing that. But today, as I return to the pulpit for the first time since having another child, I want to make sure that I highlight how this is also a great place to be with a partner, whether you live together or not, whether you have children or not. And today, I want to celebrate that this congregation is a great place for those who live alone. And I just have to get this out of the way. I'm not preaching the sermon because for the past weeks I fantasize about sleeping the night by myself. I am pre... Okay, partly. Partly. I am preaching this sermon because I see in our city and our congregation growing number of people living alone and having normal struggles, which include loneliness and frustrations, and leading beautiful lives, which include joy and hope. Eric Kleinenberg says there are at least four major contributing trends to this rise in folks living alone. Number one, there are fewer married folks. We marry later, and when we divorce, we have less commitment to find marriage again. Some women this week shared with me the saying, "I want a man in my life, but not in my house." Second factor, women's success in the work world has grown their economic independence and life choices. Third, the communications revolution actually starting importantly with the telephone, which had the fastest leap to almost everyone in the country having them. Within 12 years, I think it is, it went from 4% of U.S. households to 96% of U.S. households had telephones. And today, we can include Skype and smartphones, technologies which increase people's ability to feel connected. Fourth factor, people are living longer, outliving their spouses, or living longer as single folks. Interestingly, Unitarian Universalist thinking has had some impact on the trends of folks living alone. A strong array of Unitarians proclaimed the virtues of solitude as early as the 1800s when it was really radical. These included Margaret Fuller and Bronson Alcott. Ralph Waldo Emerson promoted self-reliance, and partly because of that, he became persona non grata at Harvard Divinity School for 20 years. Henry David Thoreau talked openly about the benefits of living alone, and he was not concerned about the side effects. He said, "There can be no melancholy to the person who lives in the midst of nature and still has his senses. I have never felt lonesome or the least oppressed by solitude," living out in his little cabin alone in Walden Pond. He went on to say, "I'm quite aware of the sweet and beneficent society of nature. It makes the fancied advantages of human neighborhood seem insignificant." For me, this next point is a fascinating element of Eric Kleinenberg's work. He says that the transcendentalists and other believers in self-reliance are not really to credit for the rising tide of folks living alone. The biggest factor in his mind, by far and wide, is urbanization. Urbanization. By the middle 1800s, people began living intentionally in metropolis areas where they shared a common belief in claiming a liberated self. Greenwich Village is a great classic example of this, where folks went there to be together, to liberate themselves alone. People's ability to connect meaningfully with shared interest groups makes a huge difference. Today we see yoga studios have social networks amongst the teachers and the students. The same is true with nonprofit volunteer cohorts who hang out with, if we volunteer on this thing that's meaningful for us, we go out and have a meal or a drink, potluck dinner, hiking clubs, and the growing diversity of religious and spiritual communities in America are amazing, and they help people live alone better, which we do too. Now keep in mind that all of these leading self-reliance thinkers enjoyed company. Henry David Thoreau had visitors out at Walden, and he often took the 30-minute walk into town or had meals in the dining room of the Emerson home with a group. Much of this dynamic, and it remains true today, is about finding balance points between self and community. There are more important insights in Mr. Kleinenberg's study. Of course, some folks who live alone do so by choice. Many of those have the economic resources to make the choice possible. Many live alone through circumstance, and probably most folks do so by some combination of choice and acceptance. Many folks who live solo do not like to be identified as such, especially not as a primary identifier. And so I want to make clear, if you are one of those folks, please do not hear me in any way saying this should be a primary identifier. But all of that, in terms of how the conversation goes, is changing somewhat with a growing number of advocacy groups and organizing campaigns. Part of what the advocacy groups do and what I think our church should be doing is to fight against the stereotypes and the myths. Common stigma have included folks living alone can be categorized by feeling very lonely or being overly self-involved. In fact, the latest studies have indicated folks who live alone do not seem to have any higher vulnerability to feeling loneliness. And most of us know from honesty of human experience that one can feel painfully alone living amongst a group, and somebody who's living alone can feel fully alive and connected with the planet. And loneliness is the farthest issue from his or her brain. This author uses the term singletons. Singletons have to go out and make it happen in terms of meaningful relationships or conversations. I know a lot of single folks who say, I've learned that I have to make a time with a friend to get together at least once every other week to have a two-hour meaningful conversation where we can go deep together, because I don't get it in my kitchen where I eat breakfast alone. Married folks can benefit from that kind of strategic thinking as well, of course. For me personally, living alone for 8 of my young adult years was precious time in self-discovery and growth. I now know that my story is like millions of others. Being alone allowed me to have fun and mature, to develop and to figure out what I really wanted and needed in romantic love. Living alone helped me take more positive actions like cooking, reading for pleasure, and going to the museums, a lot of which I do by myself. The other important point is that singletons participate vigorously in civic organizations and volunteer in many ways to help build the common goods. They volunteer as much, if not more, than married folks. And we certainly see the tremendous benefits of that in our community. Great contributions, not self-involved folks. In this way, people living alone are good for everyone. But many folks don't recognize this. Did you know, I did not know this, the federal government, United States of America, has spent millions of dollars on advertising campaigns promoting marriage, just generically promoting marriage. If we want to increase meaningful volunteerism in our communities, these studies are indicating that maybe we should also promote solo living. There are many social justice issues included in this topic, and I want to touch on a couple briefly. Like most any living situation, there is the good and the bad. Eric Kleinenberg says he got focused on this project while writing another book, which was on the 1995 brutal heat wave in Chicago that killed hundreds of folks. I was there at that time, very sad. I think, more known that a lot of folks were poor folks in rough neighborhoods where you don't leave your doors and your windows open because of safety and crime, et cetera. So they stayed shut in, and the heat overwhelmed them. But what his study also showed is most of those folks lived alone. So at that point, he became focused on this growing demographic of folks who don't always have support. In his studies, he found out another sad story. Every year in the city of Los Angeles, there's a burial service for all unclaimed dead folks. Most of them have been living alone. In 2007, there were over 1,900 folks whose ashes were memorialized in a mass burial. One chaplain and 10 witnesses were present for that ceremony. And if you think about it, that burial might have been the first time in a long time when those deceased folks were not alone. Mr. Kleinenberg says, I love his approach to the macro issues of this, facing up to the fact that since any one of us could live alone someday, it's in everyone's interest to make it a healthier, happier, more socially engaging experience. And that's a challenge we can only overcome together. Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Denmark have the highest percentage of folks living alone. In many ways, this is made possible by higher levels of commitment to social welfare structures, including publicly subsidized housing for singles, not just elderly folks, and not just the poorest of the poor, folks of all ages. He says there's a fascinating analogy between Sweden and the United States. Many communities in the United States, by the time a child is 3 or 4 years old, the parents are trying to figure out where they're going to go to school. And a lot of times we're applying for schools, we're getting on wait lists for school, we're waiting to see if we got into schools, including pre-K and kindergarten. He says that is not an issue in Sweden. The analogous thing is by the time a kid becomes an early teenager, the parents and the teenagers are strategizing how and where they can find a way for that person, when he or she becomes a young adult, to live alone. And they apply and get on waiting lists for solo living apartments in Stockholm and other places. There's no stigma to it. It's an honor because you are getting to a place where you can develop in self-knowledge and fuller become your own self. Figure out what you're doing with life. What if, as a society, we prioritized more the development of solo living for elderly, middle-aged, and young adults? In the U.S., singletons are finding their voices and working to decouple health insurance from marital status, so you don't lose your coverage if you divorce or become widowed from a partner whose employer provides it. Perhaps our USG new social justice teams can be intentional in examining how solo dwellers are affected in their issue areas. We have an economic justice group, which I think could easily focus in that way, but we have a women's rights group and reproductive justice. Women are a much higher percentage of the solo dwellers, so there are a lot of women's issues that come to play here. And I don't have time right now to go into it, but it's valuable topics. But in order to increase our impact on the macro social justice issues, we benefit from more fully living out our principles in our congregation and our personal lives. Hence, going forward, our congregation can more intentionally develop programs for folks living alone to connect and serve. Our urban congregation, the Unitarian Society of Germantown, has a strong array of ministries and programs which can help folks living alone to find happiness, fulfillment, and purpose. The choir, book group, knitting group, small group ministries, circle dinners, social justice programs such as Rebuilding Philadelphia and tutoring at our local elementary school, Lingelbach, are just some of the examples. These programs help all of us live out our Unitarian Universalist theology, which proclaims that each person Each person is able to find knowledge and strength within and make a positive impact for a better future. What if we build upon our success of caring for one another by building programs designed more specifically to meet the needs of singletons? There are countless stories of folks who are divorced or never married, who have decided not to prioritize looking for a partner. For many of those folks, one of the biggest questions or fears is, how will I be able to grow old in a safe, let alone a happy way? Let's have more open dialogue about how our currently excellent caring ministries can grow in effectiveness as we change as a society. What if, as a congregation, we more explicitly acknowledge the diverse array of relationships, not just married or single? Not all important relationships fall into those two categories. And maybe our ministries aren't meeting some needs that, if we talked, we could find out more about. Let's keep building a church where we recognize that all of us benefit from developing in the art of happiness. I pray we can share and support one another in how we are doing in balancing out the need for self-reliance and being connected with a loving community. I think we all need both. May this be a place where we all grow in self-knowledge and accessing inner strength. Together, let's build a world where folks living alone receive respect and equal opportunities for the pursuit of happiness. At one time or another, most everybody in this sanctuary will spend significant time alone. My prayer is that when you find yourself alone, you can honestly say, "This is good. This is good." Blessings be. Amen.